This past Sunday was the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, which created internment camps in some western states and displaced thousands of Japanese immigrants and even Japanese-American citizens. The effects of the camps continue to resonate today, but one overlooked element is how they have influenced the landscape of this country. Several of them were responsible for major changes in American design, architecture, and art, and the camps influenced their designs in ways that we only recently have been noting. Alexandra Lang, the architecture critic at Curb, recently wrote about this connection in an article titled "The Forgotten History of Japanese American Designers World War II Internment," and I'm very pleased that she joins us now, along with Dakin Hart, senior curator at the Noguchi Museum and the curator of a recent exhibit, Self-Interned 1942 Noguchi in Poston War Relocation Center. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about Executive Order 9066, since executive orders have been in the news recently, especially ones concerning immigration. Do you see parallels between it and the executive order that President Trump signed just a few weeks ago? Either of you want to get political here?
No, absolutely. And I say in my article that the idea of sort of separating out a population of Americans as insufficiently American is the main parallel I see between the executive orders, because Executive Order 9066 essentially turned many, many Japanese American citizens into aliens in their own country.
What did it call for?
The order itself was a military order saying that an area of the West Coast 50 miles in could be declared military property, and then you could remove people forcibly from that property. And so it was then later orders that made it more specific to Japanese Americans and also affected German Americans and Italian Americans.
Although not in the same numbers.
No.
You pretty much... The great majority of Japanese Americans, whether they were born here or born elsewhere, were sent to these camps, where only people who were deemed really dangerous out of German and the Italian communities were sent to different kinds of places. It's so obvious that this strikes people now as almost blatantly racist, and yet we think of President Roosevelt as one of our greatest presidents.
Yeah, the big difference is that German Americans and Italian Americans were treated as individuals, and Japanese Americans were treated as a race class, which is by definition racist. And the thing about Executive Order 9066 too is it's frighteningly broad. It gave the military the right to essentially impose martial law in areas that it chose itself for the defense of the country.
So, how many people were relocated, and how many were spared?
Well, the number you hear is usually around 120,000 Americans of Japanese descent, both citizens and not, Issei and Issei, first generation as well as second generation immigrants. The big difference is that if you think of the Western United States and Eastern United States as separate, those in the Eastern United States were not subject to internment because they were outside these military exclusion zones, and those in the Western United States were subject to internment.
The exhibit at the Noguchi focuses on a time when the Japanese-American artist Isamu Noguchi, a very famous artist, lived in the Poston War Relocation Center in the Arizona desert. But wasn't he exempt from the internment camps? How did he wind up in one?
He was, even though he was in California working on a number of things at the time of Pearl Harbor and then for a number of months afterwards. He made the extraordinary decision to intern himself in Poston War Relocation Center, a horrible euphemism, by the way, because he believed genuinely that he could make it a better place. He had really high aspirations. He believed deeply in the American dream, the American project. He believed in assimilation. He believed that America should be a pluralistic, multi-ethnic society, and that there was a huge amount of value in that. And he thought that he could turn Poston into a kind of ideal miniature America.
Did he have family?
Yes, he did.
Did he take them with him?
No. He didn't have a wife or children at that point. He would marry later. He never had children. He had a half-sister who he wrote to from the camps.
Was it a surprise that someone would voluntarily incarcerate himself?
Yes, I think it surprised everyone. I think it surprised him too, and it's it is arguably a great act of heroism. I think about my reaction to what's happened politically, which has been to bury my head in the sand, or wanting to bury my head in the sand. And Noguchi really chose to engage directly with evil and confront it head on.
He joined a protest group and then started the Nisei Writers and Artists Mobilization for Democracy. Now, I've known a lot about Noguchi over the years simply because he's such an important artist. I didn't know any of this history. Alexandra, is this just part of the history of American design, art, and architecture that hasn't been written much about?
It has not been written much about. I mean, I found when I started doing research for my article that in most, you know, biographies of the Japanese American designers I was looking up, there would be at most one line saying she and her family were in an internment camp with, you know, sometimes, oh, it was in Arizona or, oh, it was in California, but really very little information. And I had heard about Noguchi's experience, but as the, you know, as the exhibit at the Noguchi Museum says, like right in the wall text, his experience was extremely unusual because he was anomalous in a lot of ways, most particularly because he self-interned. And the other artists and designers that I write about did not have that choice and had, you know, a variety of experiences. But it was really knowing about that exhibit that made me want to look at the broader range of experience of Japanese American designers that we think we know about.
Dakin, he was Nisei. What does that mean?
It means he was a first generation, essentially, American, Japanese American.
Born here,
yes, to one Japanese parent. Noguchi's parentage is complicated. He was born to a mother who was actually from Brooklyn and a father who was a Japanese poet.
Before he self-incarcerated, he went to Washington to try and lobby against the camps and obviously wasn't successful.
Yeah, there was a big movement. We forget, it's easy to forget how fast all of this happened. The machinery of internment was pell-mell. I mean, it was just incredibly hasty. Following Pearl Harbor, it was felt that things had to be done very quickly. And so there was about a one-month period where Noguchi and many other Americans, Pearl Buck, for example, was a huge and important voice lobbying against, publicly making speeches again and again and again, lobbying against internment. Everybody sort of knew what was coming, and Noguchi and others were trying to essentially get Japanese Americans treated the same way that it was clear that German and Italian Americans would be, again, as individuals on a case-by-case basis, giving interviews, allowing for letters of, you know, there were these horrible, basically, proofs of loyalty that you had to make. But that still would have been better than being forcibly removed to these internment camps.
I'm speaking with Dakin Hart, senior curator at the Noguchi Museum, and with Alexandra Lang, the architecture critic at Curb magazine. She's written an article called The Forgotten History of Japanese American Designers, World War II Internment. It's hard to say that because there's an apostrophe after the word designers. It's there, the internment of those designers. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What were the living conditions like? In the case of Noguchi, he self-interned. You would have assumed that he would have known that he was what kind of situation he was getting himself into.
You know, Noguchi really went there as a kind of Baron Haussmann or Le Corbusier. He really was going to create an ideal world, a small version of an ideal world, a radiant city. He was not terribly practical going in, and I don't think he had any idea what he's in for, and I don't think anyone else did.
Was he able to get materials to make any art?
Eventually, yes. He scavenged materials from the desert. He mostly built in wood. It's an interesting wartime sculpture story, generally speaking, because a lot of the material sculptors used during wartime are embargoed to the war effort in whatever country. So he became a kind of scavenger.
And he came up, he did architectural drawings. Did any of them see fruition?
He had an awesomely grandiose plan for he called it Poston Parks and Recreation, and the idea was that if it worked, then it would be rolled out across all of the other camps, and there was actually quite a lot of interest from the other camps in getting his plans He planned for lots of public amenities, a zoo and botanical gardens, even a miniature golf course. He really believed that he could make it into an ideal American community that would help to galvanize the Japanese American community in the fight against fascism.
Was he a trained architect?
No, he wasn't. Noguchi wasn't really a trained anything, but he was an autodidact and did his homework and learned when he needed to do what he wanted to.
People who listened to the show yesterday will recognize this the name of this camp Poston in Arizona, because it was the same camp that Emiko Omori and her family were sent to, and she talked about her film based on the family's internment and the internment in general on yesterday's show. Alexandra, you wrote about this exhibit in your article. Mm-hmm. What did you think of Noguchi's architectural drawings?
I think they were very much of the period, I would say. a linear city drawn on the desert, ending in this... The most sort of fantastic element, I thought, was the botanical garden that he planned, that had a very more of a traditional Japanese garden aspect with these kind of amoebic forms. And in my article, I say that it reminded me a bit of the garden that he eventually designed for the UNESCO building in Paris. But one of the most interesting things I thought was, so Noguchi went to Poston with all these grand plans to make an ideal city, which in which he was disappointed and eventually left. But when I started reading oral histories of some other designers, most particularly Joseph Yamada, who's a landscape architect in San Diego primarily, I found that he'd been a much younger man, you know, a teenager or in his 20s then, and he described people at Poston making gardens and, you know, growing vegetables and building their own architecture out of adobe bricks, which were all things that Noguchi wanted to do and felt thwarted in, but I think eventually and perhaps more organically came to be just through the efforts of the people that were interned there.
You write about another artist at the Poston internment camp, the playwright Wakako Yamauchi. What did you learn about his life in the camp?
I believe it's a woman,
I'm
not sure.
I'm
That's okay. She wrote about, actually now I'm not remembering the exact Japanese word. I don't know if you have it there, but she wrote about just the desire of people who are in the camps to kind of do something with their energies and to kind of overcome the indignity of their incarceration.
That led to the gardening.
It led to the gardening. It led to, a lot of the older Japanese men had been chefs in their regular lives, so they took over the making of food. They set up schools. There's just a tremendous self-organization. I mean, there were a lot of children in these camps. A third of the incarcerated were children. And so, I mean, one can imagine as a parent, you don't want your children to be sitting there for months. You will organize. You insist on there being schools, and you make schools with the talents of the people that are there.
We'll find out more about those talents after we take a little break. My guests are Alexandra Lang, architecture critic at Curbed. Her recent article is The Forgotten History of Japanese American Designers, World War II Internment, and Dakin Hart, senior curator at the Noguchi Museum, curator of a recent exhibit called Self-Interned, 1942, Noguchi in Poston War Relocation Center. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Alexandra Lang, architecture critic at Curbed, and Dakin Hart, senior curator at the Noguchi Museum, talking about a surprisingly largely forgotten aspect of American design and architecture history, the impact of a whole bunch of people who were interned as part of the Japanese internment during World War II. You quote Yamauchi, who wrote of her internment, but in the spirit of shikatakanai, if I'm getting that right, I hope, or making the best of it, we bounced back. We formed softball teams, played intramural games, we produced talent shows, we set up libraries, beauty shops, cooperatives, flower and sewing classes, art and drama departments as well. So yes. In this case, we have a number of people who have a real impact on the future of American design and architecture coming out of these camps.
Yes, it was so fascinating to me because if you think of the post-war era in American architecture, there's a kind of, you know, look of America. And what I found was, you know, many, many Japanese American artists and designers made major contributions to that look. Maybe most notably, and I start my article with him, Minoru Yamasaki, the architect, designed the Twin Towers. And then there are people like Neil Fujita, a graphic designer who designed album covers for Jazz by Dave Brubeck and others.
You mentioned the G in the Godfather movie poster.
Yes, yes, yes. He designed the book cover and then the poster for the Godfather, Neil Fujita. Or Tomoko Miho, who was another graphic designer, designed ads for Herman Miller. I mean, you know, kind of what could be more post-war American than Eames Furniture and Herman Miller in your home?
Or a Corvette Stingray in your driveway.
Exactly.
So we had car designers.
Yeah,
as well.
Larry Shinoda was a car designer. And actually, there's a great story about him, just, you know, how kind of crafty and quick designers are to take on new materials. When he and his family arrived at the camp, you know, they lived in these barracks that were very sparsely furnished, and he saw some wooden crates behind a latrine, and he turned those wooden crates into chairs with reclining backs for his mother and grandmother so that they could be more comfortable in the barracks. So, I mean, I think there are just many, many examples of people, you know, kind of turning their talents to the greater good of the other incarcerated.
Let's get back to Minoru Yamasaki.
Mm-hmm.
The Twin Towers are a far cry from the situation in these internment camps. Was he already working as an architect when he was in the camp?
He was. And actually, I should specify, Yamasaki was not interned. As I say in the article, he suffered other forms of discrimination. He was already working in New York City during the war. He was working for Shreve, Lamb, and Harmon, the architects of the Empire State Building. And he was actually working on an upstate military base. And his boss, I mean, there was even people who were in, even Japanese Americans in New York were under threat of losing their jobs. And his boss very specifically said, you know, he's one of our most talented employees. There's no way I would fire him.
But his parents were targets of discrimination.
Yes, he had,
early on.
Yes, he had grown up in Seattle and his parents were still living in Seattle. And he had them come across the country and live in a 3-room apartment with him and his wife and his brother for the duration of the war so that they would not be incarcerated.
Time magazine put him on its cover in 1963.
Yes.
He and Noguchi, were they the most famous people who were affected in one way or another by Executive Order 9066?
In the design world, I would say yes. I think those are the biggest names in my story.
Although with Noguchi, it really wasn't known for a long time. Noguchi didn't talk about his experience there until after 1968 when he published an autobiography.
Hmm. Now, he had voluntarily been interned. What happened when he decided he didn't want to be there anymore?
Well, it became involuntary, yes. We get very careful to point out that his experience is not typical, is not representative of the Japanese-American experience of internment, but because he had a choice going in. But once they had him, they wouldn't let him go. He started trying to get out after about 2 months, and in the end, it took around 7 months to get out.
Was he able to make any real improvements in the camp?
No, he really didn't. He made the mistake Alexander explained earlier about the developments that did happen in the camp. That was really after Noguchi left. Some of it followed the program that he had laid out. But really, he went in even before the camp opened. He was there a few days before it opened, helping to get things set up. He went in with so much idealism and he was there too early. I think if he'd been there a year later, he might have been able to do something.
Do you see any aspects of this experience reflected in his later work?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've devoted 2 galleries at the museum to trying to trace some of the knock-on effects. Noguchi was somebody I always talk about his mental furniture. And he really created his sense of self and his understanding of what his job was in the world around places in a lot of the ways. He tried to make objects that act like places and places that feel like objects. And the desert definitely infected his sort of basic DNA. And you see that in work from the moment that he left and to the end of his life.
But he also got caught up in the politics of the camps. He wasn't trusted by other internees.
It was impossible to avoid, I think. And he was in regular contact with people in the other camps as well. There was sort of a network, unofficial network of people who published newsletters and newspapers and tried to keep each other aware of what was going on, development in the camps. And many of his friends got caught up in various forms of internecine warfare. And there were genuine splits in the camps, mostly generational, between the Issei and the Nisei, but other sorts as well. And Noguchi was, by some, viewed as a potential informer and something of a traitor because he had gone there, in a way, on the behalf of the American government to try to make the... Basically, there was a split in the American government between the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which initially had some authority over the camps because many of them ended up on Indian reservations, and there was no machinery of internment at that time. There wasn't a war relocation authority yet. As soon as it was created, it took over authority, and it really pushed the Bureau of Indian Affairs out. But the man who ran the Bureau was incredibly idealistic, and he's the one, in partnership with Noguchi, who decided that he might be able to make a difference in the camps.
Although they were housed in some pretty ramshackle conditions.
They were tar paper barracks. So when you see photos of the internment camps, they look like prison camps, and that's what they were. And they were in places where you're looking at 120 degrees in the day and 30 degrees at night. So the conditions were really brutal.
Alexander, wasn't Ray Komai, the award-winning designer, portrayed in WRA photographs as living a perfectly normal life in the camp?
Yes. So the WRA commissioned photographs of life in the camps. And then they commissioned photography of life after the camps. And if you go online, there are various internet archives, you find these very, I mean, if you know the history, they seem very peculiar photos showing kind of what sort of the happy scenes of the domestic life of Japanese Americans after the camps. And so Ray Komai is shown, he and his wife are shown, you know, playing bridge with another Japanese American couple in his apartment in New York. He's shown with some other employees at an ad agency. And they refer just like sort of in passing saying, you know, so he was originally from, you know, San Francisco and the location of one of the camps, as if, you know, he had voluntarily grown up in one place, moved to the next one for college or something, and then moved to New York. So there was definitely an effort by both the government and I would say mainstream American media to normalize this experience and kind of gloss it over. So, you know, this is just one line in your biography, and now everything's fine. You have a job in New York. You're a successful designer. That was also culturally within the Japanese American community the way a lot of them wanted to deal with it. I mean, I've been told by people that are children and grandchildren of internees that their parents or grandparents never wanted to talk about it.
This is not surprising. I've been told that people who've lived through wartime experience, soldiers, Holocaust survivors, they never seem to want to talk about the terrible things they went through.
Yes.
There's a real sense of rise above and move on and overachieve, which I think Alexandra's article does a great job of talking about. Also, the Alexandra, I think, treated it very gently. There was a terrible, very organized propaganda effort, really, by the U.S. government to try to make it appear as if not only was it not a terrible thing to have done, but actually that it improved the lives of all of these people in significant ways. And even internally within the camps, there was a huge amount of propaganda on leaflets in the camps. The internees were referred to as voluntary citizens, which is stretching credulity just a bit.
There's so many euphemisms around this. I mean, the war relocation authority. Like, what does that even mean?
Well, whether you know? They're internment camps or relocation camps or concentration camps became an issue.
Right. And even the use of the word incarceration is, I think, a more, you know, more recently, more commonly used to acknowledge what it truly was.
Can you tell us about Ruth Asawa?
Yes, yeah, so Ruth Asawa is a major American sculptor, and she was a teenager when she was sent with her mother and her siblings to the camp at Roer in Arkansas. Her father was actually separately arrested by the FBI and imprisoned in a different camp, and they didn't see him for 6 years. So she was in this camp in Arkansas, and she was actually exposed to some of her first art training in that camp from other internees, among them several men who had worked for the Disney Animation Studio. After a year or so of incarcerating these large numbers of people, the American government realized that maybe it didn't make so much sense to have especially all of these young people in these camps not doing anything. So the American Friends Service Committee worked with them to find universities that would take the college-age internees as students. And so Asawa and one of her sisters went to Teachers College up in Wisconsin. So she was training to be a teacher, and then she got to the year where she needed to be a student teacher in a school, and no school in Wisconsin would take her because she was Japanese American. Which, you know, I mean, it's like, okay, it's fine for you to train to be a teacher, but then nobody will employ you as a teacher. I mean, it's just one of these kind of mind-bending
things. 1984 kind
yeah,
of law.
Exactly.
Although later she was asked to design the Japanese American internment memorial in San Jose.
Yes, yes. And that's very... So anyway, basically, because she was thwarted by racism in her attempt to become a teacher, she then went to Black Mountain College, very important art school, and which launched her on her career to being an artist.
You write that while you have studied the works of several of these designers before, we never got to S. Neil Fujita, but we're running out of time, that this was the first time that you saw the influence of the internment camps on their designs. In what ways?
Well, there's been a lot of interpretation of their work as you know, kind of doing a lot with a little. First of all, there's the twinned Japanese and American influences. And in Asawa's case, there's also a Bauhaus influence from Black Mountain College, where Joseph and Ani Albers taught. So there are all of these sort of modernist flows, you know, in people like Asawa. And then she learned to weave in the camps. She learned to draw in the camps. And then she took that knowledge, added it to other experiences, and ended up making these woven sculptures that really were unlike anything else anyone had ever seen. I mean, they're actually also influenced by the weaving of Mexican fishermen. But just right there, you see there are all these influences coming together. And it was, in fact, you know, having time in the camps, quote-unquote free time, and having these other artists there that probably set her on the path. And she always said... you know, even as she made like quite a striking and powerful memorial sculpture, that she wasn't embittered by her experience because she had learned so much.
Dakin, you said that we didn't learn much about what Noguchi had gone through until he wrote his autobiography. What did he say in the autobiography?
Well, he just laid out the basics of the experience, which then got picked up and covered in the basic Noguchi biographies. But he's one of those people who lived a long, complicated life. So this has been always been a kind of a small chapter that hasn't gotten very much attention until now. And now it's fantastic there are people like Alexander who are diving into this period with more focus and attention.
Well, right now, we are suddenly hearing a lot about the internment camps. They have been, that history has kind of been embarrassing, and it came up as a justification for some of the recent political developments because of the court decisions of the time. So I imagine we'll be talking more about them. And again, this past Sunday was the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066. My great thanks to the two of you for being on our show, Alexandra Lang and Dakin Hart.
Thank you.
Thank you.